supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Racial bias education training is scheduled for Starbucks' 175,000 U.S. employees in the aftermath of last week's controversial arrest of two African-American men at its 18th and Spruce Street location. Following that announcement yesterday, today, members of Philadelphia's clergy met in Philadelphia with several Starbucks notables, including its chairman, Howard Schultz. Among that cohort, and joining me now is Hugh Taff Morales, leader of the Philadelphia Ethical Society. Mr. Taff Morales, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, David, very much.
What can you tell our listeners about the tenor of that conversation and what came out of it?
I think in general it was a positive meeting. There's a lot of work to be done. I was impressed by the openness of Starbucks to both defer to the clergy group, which is Power, Philadelphians Organized to Witness Power and Rebuild. They deferred to us as far as the agenda. They did most of the listening. That's what they said they were here in Philadelphia to do. And we were able to share from the perspectives of many different clergy from all different faith traditions, including humanism, from my position as clergy leader of the Philadelphia Ethical Society.
We've learned that the upcoming training will be gathered with input from groups including the NAACP and the Anti-Defamation League. Describe, then, the additional role of the clergy in shaping the agenda.
I think clergy are able to raise the level of dialogue to one that is broader in terms, that witnesses the suffering of many people in Philadelphia and around the country that are victims of systemic racism and white supremacy. I believe there is a commitment on the part of Starbucks to work in partnership with grassroots organizations, congregations, and particularly people of color who have been the greatest victims of this.
As you've suggested, the larger issues are broader than Starbucks, bigger than Philadelphia. And for those who are new to the concept, describe the term implicit bias.
Well, it's actually, it was pointed out by a colleague of color of mine at this meeting that a lot of buzzwords can be thrown around, and she asked, why do we talk about implicit bias when it is pretty explicit? It's explicit in this case. It's explicit systematically. It's purposeful. It's built into the system. I don't think that Starbucks can be held responsible for all 400 years of systemic oppression, but they understand that they are in that context. One of the things that was pointed out was that developers use as a data point when a Starbucks moves into a neighborhood, that is a sign that it is becoming gentrified. And quite often, the developments happen right on top of communities of color and people who have been living there for generations, and they're moved out. So while Starbucks can't be held responsible for all gentrification, they're a part of the system.
To be clear, Mr. Taff Morales, what form did that specific bias take last Thursday in that Starbucks location?
I wasn't there. I wasn't present. I'm not inside the mind of the manager or of the two men who were treated as poorly as they were. I would say this. It would surprise me if whoever called the police did not realize that calling the police on two black men is different than calling it on me. That awareness of what it means when you are dealing with people of color who have been on the very, very painful end of a lot of conflicts in this city, calling the police means something very different, and that's a type of awareness that I think needs to be there. The fact that they're listening, the fact that they have a track record of some progressive policies, and the fact that this hits so much at the heart of their corporate image and what they want to provide as a public service, I think there is some reason for hope. I don't want to count those chickens before they're hatched. It'll be seen over time.
Mr. Taff Morales, thank you so much for lending perspective on NewsWorks Tonight.
I appreciate it, Deb. Good luck covering the story.
Hugh Taff Morales, leader of the Philadelphia Ethical Society. It's been more than 6 months since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, yet some of the 900 families who came to Philadelphia looking for refuge still face homelessness. On Friday, 21 families who've been living in hotel rooms paid for by FEMA will have to leave, and at least 12 of them have nowhere to go. Catalina Jaramillo of WHYY's Plan Philly reports.
Teenage siblings Judy and Chris Joel Morales came from Puerto Rico in December. At first, they stayed with an aunt, but as they say, guests, like fish, stink after 3 days, so they had to leave. Now they're being pushed out again, this time from the hotel room FEMA gave their four-member family 2 months ago.
We don't have anywhere to stay. If we're kicked out of the hotel, we are totally left on the street.
The Morales family is one of 21 Puerto Rican families facing homelessness this weekend. Puerto Rican activist Charito Morales says there have been a lot of meetings trying to find out ways to help evacuees, but not a lot of action.
I'm asking the question until when, Jim Kenney? Until when, city officials? State officials? Until when, FEMA, are you going to keep playing with these families? Come up with a solution and stop this.
FEMA says paying for hotels is designed to be temporary help, while people can arrange something more long-term. It says 108 families in Pennsylvania are staying in hotels now. The city of Philadelphia has found public housing for 5 Puerto Rican families. But activists say that's not enough. They are calling on FEMA to extend the hotel program for families in need until May 14th, and for city officials to come up with a long-term solution. Catalina Jaramillo, WHYY News.
Philadelphia has decided to shutter one of its jails. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports the goal is to close it down within the next 2 years.
The House of Corrections on State Road is almost 100 years old and has been in continuous operation since 1927. City Councilman Bobby Heenan says it's in bad shape.
The inhumane conditions of HOC, is certainly undeniable. All right, but the bottom line is there shouldn't be a human being in the House of Corrections.
Mayor Jim Kenney calls it a milestone to shut it down without building a replacement prison.
Its closure is possible because of the city's overall prison population has decreased 32% since the administration took office.
The drop can be attributed, at least in part, because of a $3.5 million MacArthur Foundation grant targeted at reducing the population in city jails. District Attorney Larry Krasner, who took office in January, says they're doing things every day to keep people on the streets and out of city custody.
For example, not prosecuting possession of marijuana for that small portion who were still being prosecuted. For example, identifying 26 charges that are non-serious where we would no longer seek cash bail ordinarily. What we've seen from that is that since our bail policy went into effect, the daily decline in the numbers of incarcerated people in the county went from a 6-person reduction per day to a 12-person reduction per day. That is obviously based on many factors.
Prisons Commissioner Blanche Carney says even though there are fewer than 200 people in the House of Corrections, they can't close the facility quickly because each offender has to be moved to the right jail or prison depending on why they're serving time.
You should not house someone incarcerated solely on retail theft with someone that's charged with murder.
The group 215 Bail Coalition says the conditions at the House of Corrections are dismal and inhumane. Member Reuben Jones says he believes the city can move more quickly to mothball it permanently.
We don't feel like it needs to be maintained if it's closed, if it's not housing anyone. That's a waste of taxpayers' money.
Commissioner Carney says the facility needs to be maintained to have space available if the city's prison population increases. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Ever since Philadelphia officials announced support for opening a supervised injection facility, public debate heated up. But if you attend any one of the many community meetings on providing a space where drug users can inject with medical supervision, there's one guy you're likely to encounter, Evan Figuera Vargas. He grew up in North Philadelphia, and when he first heard about a safe injection site, he thought it was a crazy idea. Now he's turned into an all-out proponent and trying to win over others. WHYY's Alana Gordon reports that some of his toughest conversations are at home.
Supervised safe injection facilities are a heated topic in the Figuera Vargas Latour household.
It gets kind of hot.
That's Darlene Latour.
I'm like, really? We're going to enable people to get high?
On the other end is her husband, Evan.
Every life is valuable. The first step to recovery is staying alive. I know that it's going to save lives.
Opposing views aside, the two have been married for 5 years. They have a toddler, EJ, who you might hear tearing things up in the background. And they're expecting twins. Evan and Darlene have both spent most of their lives in North Philadelphia. They now live in the Northeast. And they both have firsthand experiences with addiction. For Darlene and her side of the family, it's about tough love.
We're like non-nonsense people. Like my one brother, he used to do crack cocaine. One day he woke up and was like, I'm not doing this anymore, and been clean for 35 years, you know? Like, I feel like if you don't want to do it, you're not going to do it anymore.
For Evan, the death of his older brother from an overdose in 2002, he says from a mix of cocaine and heroin, weighs heavy on him.
I definitely looked up to my brother, and it was painful. It was painful. You know, the way that society and government has responded to the opiate epidemic as opposed to the crack epidemic is completely different. So I remember, you know, my neighbors and even treatment providers and criminal justice officials calling my brother crackhead, pipero in Spanish. Like, it was just horrible.
Evan has also been in recovery for several years himself.
I was using pills and narcotics for at least 6 years. And you know what? Looking back, it feels like it was 6 months. All kind of negative things are happening.
It's amazing to see the person that he is today. Because, oh my God, he was so crazy back in the day.
I want to have a positive impact on Philadelphians. I want my life to be meaningful. I want to help people.
Evan's working on a master's in social work. He manages homeless services at the nonprofit Mental Health Partnerships. So he's often engaging and advocating for people who are actively using drugs. Last year, the city invited him to be part of its opioid task force. As for Darlene, she has a master's in forensic psychology and works at her father's auto shop in North Philly.
It's hard to because his body shop has broken into a whole bunch of times because people are looking for something that they can sell for their next high. It's always been like at first, it's like always arrest them, they're a danger.
Evan doesn't see safe injection sites, or what the city is calling comprehensive user engagement sites, or CUES, as a silver bullet. But as he researched how they've worked in other countries and as overdose deaths continue here, he thinks it's a vital approach. He's been trying to get others to see it that way too. Darlene has not been spared.
Oh my God, he just emailed me yesterday this whole proposal. When I call him in the morning, it's about cues, and then nighttime is about cues, and then when we get home, he's like, did you read what I sent you?
Sometimes it's like 2-3 in the morning, and I say, Darlene, like, I can't sleep. Can we talk about this? I mean, that's how serious I take, you know, saving somebody's life.
He wakes up and like, goes to the bathroom, and I just do, like, the slightest movement. He's like, so, yeah, you know, I was thinking about this and that. I'm like, I'm trying to sleep right now.
Darlene gets passionate, too.
I understand about saving the life. I just don't understand how it was going to work, how he was going to prevent all these deaths when people are trying to get high in that instant moment.
No, I totally agree. And I'm hopeful. Honestly, my hope for the safe injection site is that people don't just come there to get high, right? I'm hopeful that people also come there to access some supportive services around treatment support, around housing support, some sort of legal services. And
definitely so is Evan's relentless campaigning working to change Darlene's mind?
He makes some valid points.
She says she has gone from 100% opposed to being on the fence.
Because I live around here. I don't want to see people getting high all the time. So if I'm walking my son to school, will there be a safe injection site? How do I explain that to him? Like, oh, that's where people get high at, and it's okay because, you know, there's a doctor in there. How is this going to really affect our community?
She has a lot of valid points, and I think about this a lot, right?
Do you feel like you'll have, like, figured out the winning argument if you can, like, fully win over Darlene?
Absolutely not, because there's many people that do not agree with me. There's many people around me.
Evan says that includes his own parents. But he doesn't plan to let up anytime soon. With them, with Darlene, with anyone else. He wants everyone in on this tough conversation. Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
Over the past couple of years, Philadelphia's city planners and traffic engineers have been focused on making the city's streets safer. But at yesterday's budget hearing for the streets department, it became obvious that some on city council are more concerned about making the city streets faster, as Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly reports.
Could I have the transportation guru come up to the table, please? And so began Council President Daryl Clark's verbal lash in Mike Carroll, the city's deputy managing director for transportation. According to Clark, city officials are too concerned about bike lanes and not focused enough on traffic congestion. So he wanted to know,
what is the game plan for vehicular traffic?
Carroll starts to answer, but doesn't get very far.
You know, I'd like to kind of reframe a little bit.
Reframe? Meaning yeah. You don't want to talk about it?
No, I'll talk about it, but I think the idea that the traffic is growing isn't really right.
In the past 5 years, the city has formally adopted policies aimed at making streets safer for all users, including cyclists and pedestrians, not just cars. But not everyone is on board. Some say planners are ignoring the plight of drivers. According to Carroll, Philly needs to focus on safety, not speed.
The fact is, if you compare the city of Philadelphia to other cities around the country, we're not really one of the most traffic-congested cities around the country. We're like number 25. We are the worst in terms of people getting killed and injured, though. So that's the priority that the administration set to focus on, is to deal with the people who are getting killed on the streets.
So it's not about to increase traffic, because you're talking about everything but what I asked you about.
Until city officials and council can concur on what needs to be done with Philly's streetscape, not much will change. For now, though, it seems like discontent with the status quo is the only thing everyone can agree on. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
Philadelphia area screenwriters can get pointers tomorrow night in advance of submitting their entry by the May 7th deadline for this year's Set in Philadelphia screenplay competition. Joining me with a closer look at the rules is Joan Bressler, director of Greater Philadelphia Filmmakers. Joan, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Describe the competition.
It's been around actually since the 90s, but we took it over in 2002, and we've added prizes. We've added high-profile judges that can help our writers get their work done, and workshops that are open to the public, you know, to help people get their writing on target.
What are the various criteria by which a screenplay will be judged?
Well, the most important criteria is the story. A great story. But the Greater Philadelphia Film Office is tasked with bringing production to the region. So our hope is that it's a Philadelphia story, or at least can be shot in Philadelphia. And if it's a Philadelphia story, that's all the better.
Joining us now is Ben Samuels. Ben, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
And Ben and his brother Oliver put together the winning entry last year, screenplay called The Doan Brothers. And so, Ben, I understand your brother, Oliver, will be at tomorrow night's pointers session as well.
He should be there right now. I'm unfortunately out in Los Angeles, but for all the right reasons. We actually sold a film that we shot in Bucks County with Joan's support over at the film office, so I'm there in spirit.
Describe, though, your winning entry for last year's prize, The Doan Brothers.
We've made films in the area for a few years. We grew up in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, up in Bucks County, and we found a historical marker on the side of the highway about 2 years ago that told a very brief story of the Doan brothers, these Quaker bandits during the Revolution who stole horses and sold them to the British and pretty much worked both sides. And we thought it was absolutely fascinating, did a lot of our research at the local Mercer Museum, the Spruance Library, and about a year later had a working script that was an absolutely integral Philadelphia story to our revolutionary history. And when we submitted to the festival, it was with the highest hopes, but we are deeply pragmatic, both of us. So when we got the notification, it came as something of a surprise, and a great one at that.
There are five categories of entries, and did you win for two of them, both the grand prize and the Philadelphia Regional Award?
So we did, exactly, and it is truly a Philadelphia story. So much of the action is set in historic colonial Philadelphia, the surrounding area, all the way up to Bucks County, and we hope one day we'll be locally shot.
Joan, describe the different awards categories and criteria to enter.
Really, anyone can enter for the grand prize, which is a $10,000 prize. We're very excited, you know, to be able to offer that cash, but we also want to offer the opportunity of the writers to get their work seen and done and to network with each other. The second prize is the TV Primetime Award that is sponsored by Comcast and NBC Universal. The third prize is the Chamber of Commerce of Greater Philadelphia and the Arts and Business Council, which is the regional prize. That is for the best screenplay written by a Greater Philadelphian as defined by the Chamber. We also have the Michaud Prize. That is sponsored by Progressive Change, CDC, and the West Philadelphia Financial Services Institution. And that is for the best screenplay written by a writer of the African diaspora. And it's named for Oscar Micheaux because he was noted as the first African-American feature filmmaker. And our last prize is the Student Prize, and that's for a Philadelphia student. It's sponsored by the Derek Frazee Film Foundation. That's a $500 prize.
Joan, can Philadelphia aspire to be king in this realm, or will it always be subservient to New York and Los Angeles?
We are trying so hard to be king, and part of that has to do with the Pennsylvania tax credits. We need a competitive tax credit in this state for the work to keep coming. At this point, we have a wonderful tax credit program, but it's not uncapped, and we run out of money very quickly. The other part of that story is that it's a single pot of money that we share with two production centers, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, but we would each like our own pot of money, and we'd like to be able to give tax credits out to as many people as want to spend money in the greater Philadelphia region.
Well, Joan Bressler, Ben Samuels, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Joan Bressler, director of Greater Philadelphia Filmmakers, part of the Greater Philadelphia Film Office, and Ben Samuels, recipient of last year's grand prize for his offering with his brother Oliver entitled The Doan Brothers. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.